Harper Audio presents Native Son, written by Richard Wright, performed by Peter Francis James. Copyright 1940 by Richard Wright. Production copyright 2008 by HarperCollins Publishers.
12 days after the publication of Native Son in 1940, which sold over 200,000 copies in its first 3 weeks, Richard Wright gave a talk at Columbia University called How Bigger Was Born. In conclusion, he stated, I don't know if Native Son is a good book or a bad book, and I don't know if the book I'm working on now will be a good book or a bad book, and I really don't care. The mere writing of it will be more fun and a deeper satisfaction than any praise or blame from anybody. I feel that I'm lucky to be alive to write novels today, when the whole world is caught in the pangs of war and change. Early American writers, Henry James and Nathaniel Hawthorne, complained bitterly about the bleakness and flatness of the American scene. But I think that if they were alive, they'd feel at home in modern America. True, we have no great church in America. Our national traditions are still of such a sort that we are not wont to brag of them, and we have no army that's above the level of mercenary fighters. We have no group acceptable to the whole of our country upholding certain humane values. We have no rich symbols. No colorful rituals. We have only a money-grubbing, industrial civilization. But we do have in the Negro the embodiment of a past tragic enough to appease the spiritual hunger of even a James. And we have in the oppression of the Negro a shadow athwart our national life, dense and heavy enough to satisfy even the gloomy broodings of a Hawthorne. And if Poe were alive, he would not have to invent horror. Horror would invent him. And now, Native Son.
Book One. Fear. Brrring. An alarm clock clanged in the dark and silent room. A bedspring creaked. A woman's voice sang out impatiently, Vigor, shut that thing off! A surly grunt sounded above the tinny ring of metal. Naked feet swished dryly across the planks in the wooden floor, and the clang ceased abruptly.
Turn on the light, Vigor.
All right, came a sleepy mumble. Light flooded the room, and revealed a black boy standing in a narrow space between two iron beds, rubbing his eyes with the backs of his hands. From a bed to his right, the woman spoke again.
Buddy, get up from there. I got a big washing on my hands today, and I want you all out of here.
Another black boy rolled from bed and stood up. The woman also rose and stood in her nightgown.
Turn your head so I can dress, she said.
The two boys averted their eyes and gazed into a far corner of the room. The woman rushed out of her nightgown and put on a pair of step-ins. She turned to the bed from which she had risen and called,
Vera, get up from there.
What time is it, Ma?
Asked a muffled adolescent voice from beneath a quilt.
Get up from there, I say.
Okay, Ma.
A brown-skinned girl in a cotton gown got up and stretched her arms above her head and yawned. Sleepily, she sat on a chair and fumbled with her stockings. The two boys kept their faces averted while their mother and sister put on enough clothes to keep them from feeling ashamed. And the mother and sister did the same while the boys dressed. Abruptly, they all paused, holding their clothes in their hands, their attention caught by a light tapping in the thinly plastered walls of the room. They forgot their conspiracy against shame, and their eyes strayed apprehensively over the floor.
"There he is again, Bigger!"
the woman screamed, and the tiny one-room apartment galvanized into violent action. A chair toppled as the woman, half-dressed and in her stocking feet, scrambled breathlessly upon the bed. Her two sons, barefoot, stood tense and motionless, their eyes searching anxiously under the bed and chairs. The girl ran into a corner, half-stooped, and gathered the hem of her slip into both of her hands and held it tightly over her knees.
"Oh, oh!" she wailed. "There he goes!"
The woman pointed a shaking finger. Her eyes were round with fascinated horror.
"Where? I don't see him." "Bigger, he's behind the trunk," the girl whimpered. "Vera," the woman screamed, "get up here on the bed. Don't let that thing bite you."
Frantically, Vera climbed upon the bed and the woman caught hold of her. With their arms entwined about each other, the black mother and the brown daughter gazed open-mouthed at the trunk in the corner. Bigger looked round the room wildly, then darted to a curtain and swept it aside, and grabbed two heavy iron skillets from a wall above a gas stove. He whirled and called softly to his brother, his eyes glued to the trunk.
"Buddy."
"Yeah?"
"Here, take this skillet."
"Okay."
"Now, get over by the door."
"Okay."
Buddy crouched by the door and held the iron skillet by its handle, his arm flexed and poised. Save for the quick, deep breathing of the four people, the room was quiet. Bigger crept on tiptoe toward the trunk with the skillet clutched stiffly in his hand, his eyes dancing and watching every inch of the wooden floor in front of him. He paused, and without moving an eye or muscle, called,
"Buddy."
"Huh?"
"Put that box in front of the hole so he can't get out."
"Okay."
Buddy ran to a wooden box and shoved it quickly in front of a gaping hole in the molding, and then backed again to the door, holding the skillet ready. Bigger eased to the trunk and peered behind it cautiously. He saw nothing. Carefully, he stuck out his bare foot and pushed the trunk a few inches.
"There he is!"
the mother screamed again. A huge black rat squealed and leaped at Bigger's trouser leg and snagged it in his teeth, hanging on.
"Goddamn!"
Bigger whispered fiercely, whirling and kicking out his leg with all the strength of his body. The force of his movement shook the rat loose, and it sailed through the air and struck a wall. Instantly, it rolled over and leaped again. Bigger dodged, and the rat landed against a table leg. With clenched teeth, Bigger held the skillet. He was afraid to hurl it, fearing that he might miss. The rat squeaked and turned and ran in a narrow circle, looking for a place to hide. It leaped again past Bigger and scurried on dry, rasping feet to one side of the box and then to the other, searching for the hole. Then it turned and reared upon its hind legs.
"Hit him, Bigger!"
Buddy shouted.
"Kill him!"
the woman screamed. The rat's belly pulsed with fear. Bigger advanced a step, and the rat emitted a long, thin song of defiance, its black, beady eyes glittering, its tiny forefeet pawing the air restlessly. Bigger swung the skillet. It skidded over the floor, missing the rat, and clattered to a stop against a wall.
"Goddamn!"
The rat leaped. Bigger sprang to one side. The rat stopped under a chair and let out a furious squeak. Bigger moved slowly backward toward the door.
"Give me that skillet, buddy,"
he asked quietly, not taking his eyes from the rat. Buddy extended his hand. Bigger caught the skillet and lifted it high in the air. The rat scuttled across the floor and stopped again at the box and searched quickly for the hole. Then it reared once more and bared long yellow fangs, piping shrilly, belly quivering. Bigger aimed and let the skillet fly with a heavy grunt. There was a shattering of wood as the box caved in. The woman screamed and hid her face in her hands. Bigger tiptoed forward and peered.
"I got him,"
he muttered, his clenched teeth bared in a smile.
By God, I got him.
He kicked the splintered box out of the way, and the flat, black body of the rat lay exposed, its two long yellow tusks showing distinctly. Bigger took a shoe and pounded the rat's head, crushing it, cursing hysterically.
You son of a bitch!
The woman on the bed sank to her knees and buried her face in the quilts and sobbed,
Lord, Lord, have mercy!
Oh, Mama,
Vera whimpered, bending to her.
Don't cry, it's dead now.
The two brothers stood over the dead rat and spoke in tones of awed admiration.
Gee, but he's a big bastard. That son of a bitch could cut your throat.
He's over a foot long.
How in hell did they get so big?
Eating garbage and anything else they can get.
Look, Bigger, there's a 3-inch rip in your pant leg.
Yeah, he was after me, all right.
Please, Bigger, take him out, Vera begged.
Aw, don't be so scary, Buddy said.
The woman on the bed continued to sob. Bigger took a piece of newspaper and gingerly lifted the rat by its tail and held it out at arm's length.
Bigger, take him out, Vera begged again.
Bigger laughed and approached the bed with the dangling rat, swinging it to and fro like a pendulum, enjoying his sister's fear.
Bigger!
Vera gasped convulsively. She screamed and swayed and closed her eyes and fell headlong across her mother and rolled limply from the bed to the floor.
Bigger, for God's sake!
The mother sobbed, rising and bending over Vera.
Don't do that! Throw that rat out!
He laid the rat down and started to dress.
Bigger, help me lift Vera to the bed, the mother said.
He paused and turned round. What's the matter? He asked, feigning ignorance.
Do what I asked you, will you, boy?
He went to the bed and helped his mother lift Vera. Vera's eyes were closed. He turned away and finished dressing. He wrapped the rat in a newspaper and went out of the door and down the stairs and put it into a garbage can at the corner of an alley. When he returned to the room, his mother was still bent over Vera, placing a wet towel upon her head. She straightened and faced him, her cheeks and eyes wet with tears and her lips tight with anger.
Boy, sometimes I wonder what makes you act like you do.
What I do now? He demanded belligerently.
Sometimes you act the biggest fool I ever saw.
What you talking about?
You scared your sister with that rat, and she fainted. Ain't you got no sense at all?
Oh, I didn't know she was that scary.
Buddy,
the mother called.
Yes'm?
Take a newspaper and spread it over that spot.
Yes'm.
Buddy opened out a newspaper and covered the smear of blood on the floor where the rat had been crushed. Bigger went to the window and stood looking out abstractedly into the street. His mother glared at his back.
Bigger, sometimes I wonder why I birthed you, she said bitterly.
Bigger looked at her and turned away.
Maybe you oughtn't have. Maybe you ought to have left me where I was.
You shut your sassy mouth.
Oh, for Christ's sakes,
Bigger said, lighting a cigarette.
Buddy, pick up them skillets and put them in the sink, the mother said.
Yes'm.
Bigger walked across the floor and sat on the bed. His mother's eyes followed him.
We wouldn't have to live in this garbage dump if you had any manhood in you, she said.
Oh, don't start that again.
How you feel, Vera?
The mother asked. Vera raised her head and looked about the room as though expecting to see another rat.
Oh, Mama!
You poor thing.
I couldn't help it. Bigger scared me.
Did you hurt yourself?
I bumped my head.
Here, take it easy. You'll be all right.
How come Bigger acts that way?
Vera asked, crying again.
He's just crazy, the mother said. Just plain dumb black crazy.
I'll be late for my sewing class at the YWCA, Vera said.
Here, stretch out on the bed. You'll feel better in a little while, the mother said.
She left Vera on the bed and turned a pair of cold eyes upon Bigger.
Suppose you wake up some morning and find your sister dead. What would you think then? She asked. Suppose those rats cut our veins at night when we sleep?
Nah.
Nothing like that ever bothers you. All you care about is your own pleasure. Even when the relief offers you a job, you won't take it till they threaten to cut off your food and starve you.
Bigger, honest, you the most no-counters man I ever seen in all my life.
You done told me that 1,000 times, he said, not looking around.
Well, I'm telling you again, and mark my word, some of these days you're going to sit down and cry. Some of these days you're going to wish you had made something out of yourself, instead of just a tramp. But it'll be too late then.
Stop prophesying about me, he said.
I prophesy much as I please, and if you don't like it, you can get out. We can get along without you. We can live in one room just like we live in now, even with you gone, she said.
Oh, for Christ's sake, he said, his voice filled with nervous irritation.
You'll regret how you live in someday, she went on. If you don't stop running with that gang of yours and do right, you'll end up where you never thought you would.
You think I don't know what you boys is doing, but I do. And the gallows is at the end of the road, you traveling boy. Just remember that.
She turned and looked at Buddy.
Throw that box outside, Buddy.
Yes'm.
There was silence. Buddy took the box out. The mother went behind the curtain to the gas stove. Vera sat up in bed and swung her feet to the floor.
Lay back down, Vera, the mother said.
I feel all right now, Ma. I got to go to my sewing class.
Well, if you feel like it, set the table, the mother said, going behind the curtain again.
Lord, I get so tired of this, I don't know what to do.
Her voice floated plaintively from behind the curtain.
All I ever do is try to make a home for you children, and you don't care.
Oh, Ma, Vera protested. Don't say that.
Vera, sometimes I just want to lay down and quit.
Ma, please don't say that.
I can't last many more years living like this.
I'll be old enough to work soon, Ma.
I reckon I'll be dead then. I reckon God'll call me home.
Vera went behind the curtain, and Bigger heard her trying to comfort his mother. He shut their voices out of his mind. He hated his family, because he knew that they were suffering and that he was powerless to help them. He knew that the moment he allowed himself to feel to its fullness how they lived, the shame and misery of their lives, he would be swept out of himself with fear and despair. So he held toward them an attitude of iron reserve. He lived with them, but behind a wall, a curtain. And toward himself, he was even more exacting. He knew that the moment he allowed what his life meant to enter fully into his consciousness, he would either kill himself or someone else. So he denied himself and acted tough. He got up and crushed his cigarette upon the windowsill. Vera came into the room and placed knives and forks upon the table.
Get ready to eat, y'all, the mother called.
He sat at the table. The odor of frying bacon and boiling coffee drifted to him from behind the curtain. His mother's voice floated to him in song.
Life is like a mountain railroad, with an engineer that's brave. We must make the run successful. From the cradle to the grave.
The song irked him, and he was glad when she stopped and came into the room with a pot of coffee and a plate of crinkled bacon. Vera brought the bread in, and they sat down. His mother closed her eyes and lowered her head and mumbled,
Lord, we thank thee for the food you done placed before us for the nourishment of our bodies. Amen.
She lifted her eyes, and without changing her tone of voice, said,
You're going to have to learn to get up earlier than this beggar to hold a job.
He did not answer or look up.
You want me to pour you some coffee? Vera asked.
Yeah.
You're going to take the job, ain't you, beggar?
His mother asked. He laid down his fork and stared at her.
I told you last night I was going to take it.
How many times you want to ask me?
But don't bite her head off, Vera said. She only asked you a question.
Pass the bread and stop being smart.
You know you have to see Mr. Dalton at 5:30,
his mother said.
You done said that 10 times.
I don't want you to forget, son.
And you know how you can forget, Vera said.
I'll lay off, bigger, Buddy said. He told you he was going to take the job.
Don't tell him nothing, Bigger said.
You shut your mouth, Buddy, or get up from this table, the mother said. I'm not going to take any stinking sass from you. One fool in the family's enough.
Lay off, Ma, Buddy said.
Bigger's sitting here like he ain't glad to get a job, she said.
What you want me to do, shout? Bigger asked.
Oh, Bigger, his sister said.
I wish you'd keep your big mouth out of this, he told his sister.
If you get that job, his mother said in a low, kind tone of voice, busy slicing a loaf of bread, I can fix up a nice place for you children. You could be comfortable and not have to live like pigs.
Bigger ain't decent enough to think of nothing like that, Vera said.
God, I wish you all would let me eat, Bigger said.
His mother talked on as though she had not heard him, and he stopped listening.
Ma's talking to you, Bigger,
Vera said.
So what?
Don't be that way, Bigger.
He laid down his fork, and his strong black fingers gripped the edge of the table. There was silence, save for the tinkling of his brother's fork against a plate. He kept staring at his sister till her eyes fell.
I wish you'd let me eat, he said again.
As he ate, he felt that they were thinking of the job he was to get that evening, and it made him angry. He felt that they had tricked him into a cheap surrender.
I need some car fare, he said.
Here's all I got,
his mother said, pushing a quarter to the side of his plate. He put the quarter in his pocket and drained his cup of coffee in one long swallow. He got his coat and cap and went to the door.
You know, Bigger, his mother said. If you don't take that job, the relief will cut us off. We won't have any food.
I told you I'd take it,
he shouted and slammed the door. He went down the steps into the vestibule and stood looking out into the street through the plate glass of the front door. Now and then a streetcar rattled past over steel tracks. He was sick of his life at home. Day in and day out, there was nothing but shouts and bickering. But what could he do? Each time he asked himself that question, his mind hit a blank wall and he stopped thinking. Across the street, directly in front of him, he saw a truck pull to a stop at the curb, and two white men in overalls got out with pails and brushes. Yes, he could take the job at Dalton's and be miserable, or he could refuse it and starve. It maddened him to think that he did not have a wider choice of action. Well, he could not stand here all day like this. What was he to do with himself? He tried to decide if he wanted to buy a 10-cent magazine or go to a movie, or go to the pool room and talk with the gang, or just loaf around. With his hands deep in his pockets, another cigarette slanting across his chin, he brooded and watched the men at work across the street. They were pasting a huge colored poster to a signboard. The poster showed a white face.
That's Buckley.
He spoke softly to himself. He's running for state's attorney again. The men were slapping the poster with wet brushes. He looked at the round, florid face and wagged his head. I bet that son of a bitch rakes off $1 million in graft a year. Boy, if I was in his shoes for just one day, I'd never have to worry again. When the men were through, they gathered up their pails and brushes and got into the truck and drove off. He looked at the poster. The white face was fleshy, but stern. One hand was uplifted, and its index finger pointed straight out into the street at each passerby. The poster showed one of those faces that looked straight at you when you looked at it. And all the while you were walking and turning your head to look at it, it kept looking unblinkingly back at you, until you got so far from it you had to take your eyes away, and then it stopped, like a movie blackout. Above the top of the poster were tall red letters, "You Can't Win." He snuffed his cigarette and laughed silently. "You crook," he mumbled, shaking his head. "You let whoever pays you off win." He opened the door and met the morning air. He went along the sidewalk with his head down, fingering the quarter in his pocket. He stopped and searched all of his pockets. In his vest pocket, he found a lone copper cent. That made a total of 26 cents, 14 cents of which would have to be saved for car fare to Mr. Dalton's. That is, if he decided to take the job. In order to buy a magazine and go to the movies, he would have to have at least 20 cents more. "God damn it, I'm always broke," he mumbled. He stood on the corner in the sunshine, watching cars and people pass. He needed more money. If he did not get more than he had now, he would not know what to do with himself for the rest of the day. He wanted to see a movie. His senses hungered for it. In a movie, he could dream without effort. All he had to do was lean back in his seat and keep his eyes open. He thought of Gus and G.H. and Jack. Should he go to the pool room and talk with them? But there was no use in his going, unless they were ready to do what they had been long planning to do. If they could, it would mean some sure and quick money. From 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, there was no policeman on duty in the block where Blum's delicatessen was, and it would be safe. One of them could hold a gun on Blum and keep him from yelling. One could watch the front door. One could watch the back. And one could get the money from the box under the counter. Then all four of them could lock Blum in the store and run out through the back and duck down the alley and meet an hour later, either at Doc's pool room or at the Southside Boys Club, and split the money. Holding up Blum ought not take more than 2 minutes at the most, and it would be their last job, but it would be the toughest one that they had ever pulled. All the other times they had raided newsstands, fruit stands, and apartments. And, too, they had never held up a white man before. They had always robbed Negroes. They felt that it was much easier and safer to rob their own people, for they knew that white policemen never really searched diligently for Negroes who committed crimes against other Negroes. For months, they had talked of robbing Blums, but had not been able to bring themselves to do it. They had the feeling that the robbing of Blums would be a violation of ultimate taboo. It would be a trespassing into territory where the full wrath of an alien white world would be turned loose upon them. In short, it would be a symbolic challenge of the white world's rule over them, a challenge which they yearned to make, but were afraid to. Yes, if they could rob Blum's, it would be a real hold-up, in more senses than one. In comparison, all of their other jobs had been play.
"Goodbye, Bigger."
He looked up and saw Vera passing with a sewing kit dangling from her arm. She paused at the corner and came back to him. "Now what you want?"
"Bigger, please. You're getting a good job now. Why don't you stay away from Jack and Gus and G.H. and keep out of trouble?" You keep your big mouth out of my business.
But Bigger...
Go on to school, will you?
She turned abruptly and walked on. He knew that his mother had been talking to Vera and Buddy about him, telling them that if he got into any more trouble, he would be sent to prison and not just to the reform school, where they sent him last time. He did not mind what his mother said to Buddy about him. Buddy was all right. Tough. Plenty. But Vera was a sappy girl. She did not have any more sense than to believe everything she was told. He walked toward the pool room. When he got to the door, he saw Gus half a block away, coming toward him. He stopped and waited. It was Gus who had first thought of robbing Blum's.
Hi, Bigger.
What you saying, Gus?
Nothing. Seen G.H. or Jack yet?
Nah. You?
Nah. Say, got a cigarette?
Yeah.
Bigger took out his pack and gave Gus a cigarette. He lit his and held the match for Gus. They leaned their backs against the red brick wall of a building, smoking, their cigarettes slanting white across their black chins. To the east, Bigger saw the sun burning a dazzling yellow. In the sky above him, a few big white clouds drifted. He puffed silently, relaxed, his mind pleasantly vacant of purpose. Every slight movement in the street evoked a casual curiosity in him. Automatically, his eyes followed each car as it whirred over the smooth black asphalt. A woman came by, and he watched the gentle sway of her body until she disappeared into a doorway. He sighed, scratched his chin, and mumbled,
"Kind of warm today."
"Yeah,"
Gus said. "You get more heat from this sun than from them old radiators at home."
"Yeah. Them old white landlords sure don't give much heat.
They always knocking at your door for money."
"I'll be glad when summer comes."
"Me too," Bigger said.
He stretched his arms above his head and yawned. His eyes moistened. The sharp precision of the world of steel and stone dissolved into blurred waves. He blinked, and the world grew hard again, mechanical, distinct. A weaving motion in the sky made him turn his eyes upward. He saw a slender streak of billowing white blooming against the deep blue. A plane was riding high up in the air.
"Look," Bigger said.
"What?"
"That plane riding up there," Bigger said, pointing.
"Oh!"
They squinted at a tiny ribbon of unfolding vapor that spelled out the word, "Use." The plane was so far away that at times the strong glare of the sun blanked it from sight.
"You can hardly see it," Gus said.
"Looks like a little bird,"
Bigger breathed with childlike wonder.
"Them white boys sure can fly," Gus said.
"Yeah," Bigger said wistfully. "They get a chance to do everything."
Noiselessly, the tiny plane looped and veered, vanishing and appearing, leaving behind it a long trail of white plumage, like coils of fluffy paste being squeezed from a tube. A plume coil that grew and swelled and slowly began to fade into the air at the edges. The plane wrote another word, "Speed."
"How high you reckon he is?" Bigger asked.
"I don't know. Maybe 100 miles? Maybe 1,000?
"I could fly one of them things if I had a chance,"
Bigger mumbled reflectively, as though talking to himself. Gus pulled down the corners of his lips, stepped out from the wall, squared his shoulders, doffed his cap, bowed low, and spoke with mock deference.
"Yes, sir."
"You go to hell," Bigger said, smiling.
"Yes, sir,"
Gus said again.
"I could fly a plane if I had a chance," Bigger said.
"If you wasn't black, and if you had some money, and if they'd let you go to that aviation school, you could fly a plane," Gus said.
For a moment, Bigger contemplated all the ifs that Gus had mentioned. Then both boys broke into hard laughter, looking at each other through squinted eyes. When their laughter subsided, Bigger said in a voice that was half question and half statement, "It's funny how the white folks treat us, ain't it?"
"It better be funny," Gus said.
"Maybe they're right in not wanting us to fly," Bigger said. "'Cause if I took a plane up, I'd take a couple of bombs along and drop 'em as sure as hell."
They laughed again, still looking upward. The plane sailed and dipped and spread another word against the sky. Gasoline. "Use speed gasoline," Bigger mused, rolling the word slowly from his lips.
"God, I'd like to fly up there in that sky."
"God'll let you fly when he gives you your wings up in heaven," Gus said.
They laughed again, reclining against the wall, smoking. The lids of their eyes drooped softly against the sun. Cars whizzed past on rubber tires. Bigger's face was metallically black in the strong sunlight. There was in his eyes a pensive, brooding amusement, as of a man who had been long confronted and tantalized by a riddle whose answer seemed always just on the verge of escaping him, but prodding him irresistibly on to seek its solution. The silence irked Bigger. He was anxious to do something to evade looking so squarely at this problem.
"Let's play white,"
Bigger said, referring to a game of play-acting in which he and his friends imitated the ways and manners of white folks.
"I don't feel like it," Gus said. "General,"
Bigger pronounced in a sonorous tone, looking at Gus expectantly.
"Oh, hell, I don't want to play," Gus whined.
"You'll be court-martialed,"
Bigger said, snapping out his words with military precision.
"Nigga, you nuts," Gus laughed.
"General,"
Bigger tried again, determinedly. Gus looked wearily at Bigger, then straightened, saluted, and answered.
"Yes, sir."
"Send your men over the river at dawn and attack the enemy's left flank," Bigger ordered.
"Yes, sir."
"Send the 5th, 6th, and 7th regiments," Bigger said, frowning, "and attack with tanks, gas, planes, and infantry."
"Yes, sir,"
Gus said again, saluting and clicking his heels. For a moment they were silent, facing each other, their shoulders thrown back, their lips compressed to hold down the mounting impulse to laugh. Then they guffawed, partly at themselves and partly at the vast white world that sprawled and towered in the sun before them.
"Say, what's a left flank?" Gus asked.
"I don't know," Bigger said. "I heard it in the movies."
They laughed again. After a bit, they relaxed and leaned against the wall, smoking. Bigger saw Gus cup his left hand to his ear, as though holding a telephone receiver, and cup his right hand to his mouth, as though talking into a transmitter.
"Hello,"
Gus said.
"Hello," Bigger said. "Who's this?"
"This is Mr. J.P. Morgan speaking," Gus said.
"Yes, sir, Mr. Morgan,"
Bigger said, his eyes filled with mock adulation and respect.
"I want you to sell 20,000 shares of U.S. Steel in the market this morning," Gus said.
"At what price, sir?"
Bigger asked.
"Oh, just dump 'em at any price,"
Gus said with casual irritation.
"We're holding too much."
"Yes, sir," Bigger said.
"And call me at my club at 2 this afternoon and tell me if the president telephoned," Gus said.
"Yes, sir, Mr. Morgan," Bigger said.
Both of them made gestures signifying that they were hanging up telephone receivers. Then they bent double, laughing.
"I bet that's just the way they talk," Gus said.
"I wouldn't be surprised," Bigger said.
They were silent again. Presently, Bigger cupped his hand to his mouth and spoke through an imaginary telephone transmitter.
Hello?
Hello? Gus answered. Who's this?
This is the President of the United States speaking, Bigger said.
Oh, yes, sir, Mr. President, Gus said.
I'm calling a cabinet meeting this afternoon at 4 o'clock, and you, as Secretary of State, must be there.
Well, now, Mr. President, Gus said, I'm pretty busy. They're raising sand over there in Germany, and I got to send them a note.
But this is important, Bigger said.
What are you going to take up at this cabinet meeting? Gus asked.
Well, you see, the niggers is raising sand all over the country, Bigger said, struggling to keep back his laughter. We've got to do something with these black folks.
Oh, if it's about the niggers, I'll be right there, Mr. President, Gus said.
They hung up imaginary receivers and leaned against the wall and laughed. A streetcar rattled by. Bigger sighed and swore. God damn it.
What's the matter?
They don't let us do nothing.
Who?
The white folks.
You talk like you just now finding that out, Gus said.
No, but I just can't get used to it, Bigger said. I swear to God, I can't. I know I oughtn't think about it, but I can't help it. Every time I think about it, I feel like somebody's poking a red-hot iron down my throat. God damn it, look. We live here, and they live there. We black and they white. They got things and we ain't. They do things and we can't. It's just like living in jail. Half the time I feel like I'm on the outside of the world, peeping in through a knothole in the fence.
I ain't no use feeling that way about it. It don't help none, Gus said.
You know one thing? Bigger said.
What?
Sometimes I feel like something awful's going to happen to me. Bigger spoke with a tinge of bitter pride in his voice.
What you mean?
Gus asked, looking at him quickly. There was fear in Gus's eyes. I don't know. I just feel that way. Every time I get to thinking about me being black and they being white, me being here and they being there, I feel like something awful is going to happen to me.
Oh, for Christ's sakes, there ain't nothing you can do about it. How come you want to worry yourself? You black and they make the laws.
Why they make us live in one corner of the city? Why don't they let us fly planes and run ships?
Gus hunched Bigger with his elbow and mumbled good-naturedly.
Aw, nigger, quit thinking about it. You'll go nuts.
The plane was gone from the sky, and the white plumes of floating smoke were thinly spread, vanishing. Because he was restless and had time on his hands, Bigger yawned again and hoisted his arms high above his head.
Nothing ever happens, he complained.
What you want to happen?
Anything,
Bigger said with a wide sweep of his dingy palm, a sweep that included all the possible activities of the world. Then their eyes were riveted. A slate-colored pigeon swooped down to the middle of the streetcar tracks and began strutting to and fro with ruffled feathers, its fat neck bobbing with regal pride. A streetcar rumbled forward, and the pigeon rose swiftly through the air, on wings stretched so taut and sheer that Bigger could see the gold of the sun through their translucent tips. He tilted his head and watched the slate-colored bird flap and wheel out of sight over the edge of a high roof.
Now if I could only do that, Bigger said.
Gus laughed. Nigger, you nuts.
I reckon we the only things in this city that can't go where we want to go and do what we want to do.
Don't think about it, Gus said.
I can't help it.
That's why you're feeling like something awful's going to happen to you, Gus said. You think too much.
What in hell can a man do? Bigger asked, turning to Gus.
Get drunk and sleep it off.
I can't,
I'm broke.
Bigger crushed his cigarette and took out another one and offered the package to Gus. They continued smoking. A huge truck swept past, lifting scraps of white paper into the sunshine. The bits settled down slowly.
Gus? Huh?
You know where the white folks live?
Yeah, Gus said, pointing eastward.
Over across the line. Over there on Cottage Grove Avenue.
Nah, they don't, Bigger said.
What you mean?
Gus asked, puzzled.
And where do they live?
Bigger doubled his fist and struck his solar plexus.
Right down here in my stomach, he said.
Gus looked at Bigger searchingly, then away, as though ashamed.
Yeah, I know what you mean, he whispered.
Every time I think of them, I feel them, Bigger said.
Yeah, and in your chest and throat too, Gus said.
It's like fire.
And sometimes you can't hardly breathe.
Bigger's eyes were wide and placid, gazing into space.
That's when I feel like something awful's going to happen to me.
Bigger paused, narrowed his eyes.
No, it ain't like something going to happen to me. It's like I was going to do something I can't help.
Yeah,
Gus said with an uneasy eagerness. His eyes were full of a look compounded of fear and admiration for Bigger.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's like you're going to fall and don't know where you're going to land.
Gus's voice trailed off. The sun slid behind a big white cloud and the street was plunged in cool shadow. Quickly, the sun edged forth again, and it was bright and warm once more. A long, sleek black car, its fenders glinting like glass in the sun, shot past them at high speed and turned a corner a few blocks away. Bigger pursed his lips and sang.
Zoom. They got everything, Gus said.
They own the world, Bigger said.
Oh, what the hell, Gus said. Let's go in the pool room.
Okay.
They walked toward the door of the pool room.
Say, you taking that job you told us about?
Gus asked.
I don't know.
You talk like you don't want it.
Oh, hell yes, I want the job, Bigger said.
They looked at each other and laughed. They went inside. The pool room was empty, save for a fat black man who held a half-smoked, unlit cigar in his mouth and leaned on the front counter. To the rear burned a single green-shaded bulb.
Hi, Doc, Bigger said.
You boys kind of early this morning,
Doc said.
Jack a G.H. around yet?
Bigger asked.
No,
Doc said.
Let's shoot a game, Gus said.
I'm broke, Bigger said.
I got some money. Switch on the light. The ball's a rack,
Doc said. Bigger turned on the light. They lagged for first shot. Bigger won. They started playing. Bigger's shots were poor. He was thinking of Blum's, fascinated with the idea of the robbery, and a little afraid of it.
Remember what we talked about so much? Bigger asked in a flat, neutral tone.
No.
Old Blum.
Oh, Gus said. We ain't talked about that for a month. How come you think of it all of a sudden?
Let's clean the place out.
I don't know.
It was your plan from the start, Bigger said.
Gus straightened and stared at Bigger, then at Doc, who was looking out the front window.
You going to tell Doc? Can't you never learn to talk low?
Oh, I was just asking you, do you want to try it?
No.
How come? You scared 'cause he's a white man?
No, but Blum keeps a gun. Suppose he beats us to it.
Are you scared, that's all. He's a white man and you scared.
The hell I'm scared.
Gus, hurt and stung, defended himself. Bigger went to Gus and placed an arm about his shoulders.
Listen, you won't have to go in. You just stand at the door and keep watch, see? B and Jack and G.H. will go in. If anybody comes along, you whistle, and we'll go out the back way, that's all.
The front door opened. They stopped talking and turned their heads. Here comes Jack and G.H. now, Bigger said. Jack and G.H. walked to the rear of the pool room.
What you guys doing? Jack asked.
Shooting a game, want to play? Bigger asked.
You asking them to play and I'm paying for the game, Gus said.
They all laughed, and Bigger laughed with them, but stopped quickly. He felt that the joke was on him, and he took a seat alongside the wall and propped his feet upon the rungs of a chair, as though he had not heard. Gus and G.H. kept on laughing.
You niggas is crazy, Bigger said. You laugh like monkeys, and you ain't got nerve enough to do nothing but talk.
What you mean? G.H. asked.
I got a haul all figured out, Bigger said.
What haul?
Old Blum's.
There was silence. Jack lit a cigarette. Gus looked away, avoiding the conversation.
If Old Blum was a black man, you all would be itching to go. 'Cause he's white, everybody's scared.
I ain't scared, Jack said. I'm with you.
You say you got it all figured out? G.H. asked.
Bigger took a deep breath and looked from face to face. It seemed to him that he should not have to explain.
Look, it'll be easy. There ain't nothing to be scared of. Between 3 and 4 ain't nobody in the store but the old man. The cop is way down at the other end of the block. One of us will stay outside and watch. 3 of us go in, see? One of us will throw a gun on Old Blum. One of us will make for the cash box under the counter. One of us will make for the back door and have it open so we can make a quick getaway down the back alley. That's all. It won't take 3 minutes.
I thought we said we wasn't never going to use a gun, G.H. said. And we ain't bothered no white folks before.
Can't you see? This is something big, Bigger said.
He waited for more objections. When none were forthcoming, he talked again.
We can do it if you niggas ain't scared.
Save for the sound of Doc's whistling up front, there was silence. Bigger watched Jack closely. He knew that the situation was one in which Jack's word would be decisive. Bigger was afraid of Gus, because he knew that Gus would not hold out if Jack said yes. Gus stood at the table, toying with a cue stick, his eyes straying lazily over the billiard balls, scattered about the table in the array of an unfinished game. Bigger rose, and sent the balls whirling with a sweep of his hand, then looked straight at Gus, as the gleaming balls kissed and rebounded from the rubbered cushions, zigzagging across the table's green cloth. Even though Bigger had asked Gus to be with him in the robbery, the fear that Gus would really go made the muscles of Bigger's stomach tighten. He was hot all over. He felt as if he wanted to sneeze and could not, only it was more nervous than wanting to sneeze. He grew hotter, tighter. His nerves were taut and his teeth were on edge. He felt that something would soon snap within him.
God damn it, say something, somebody.
I'm in, Jack said again.
I'll go if the rest goes, G.H. said.
Gus stood without speaking, and Bigger felt a curious sensation, half sensual, half thoughtful. He was divided and pulled against himself. He had handled things just right so far. All but Gus had consented. The way things stood now, there were 3 against Gus, and that was just as he had wanted it to be. Bigger was afraid of robbing a white man, and he knew that Gus was afraid, too. Blum's store was small, and Blum was alone, but Bigger could not think of robbing him without being flanked by his 3 pals. But even with his pals, he was afraid.
He had argued all of his pals but one into consenting to the robbery. And toward the lone man who held out, he felt a hot hate and fear. He had transferred his fear of the whites to Gus. He hated Gus, because he knew that Gus was afraid, as even he was. And he feared Gus, because he felt that Gus would consent, and then he would be compelled to go through with the robbery. Like a man about to shoot himself, and dreading to shoot, and yet knowing that he has to shoot, and feeling it all at once and powerfully, he watched Gus and waited for him to say yes. But Gus did not speak. Bigger's teeth clamped so tight that his jaws ached. He edged toward Gus, not looking at Gus, but feeling the presence of Gus all over his body, through him, in and out of him, and hating himself and Gus because he felt it. Then he could not stand it any longer. The hysterical tensity of his nerves urged him to speak, to free himself. He faced Gus, his eyes red with anger and fear, his fists clenched and held stiffly to his sides. "You black son of a bitch," he said in a voice that did not vary in tone. "You scared 'cause he's a white man." "Don't cuss me, Bigger," Gus said quietly. "I am cussing you." "You don't have to cuss me," Gus said. "Then why don't you use that black tongue of yours?" Bigger asked. "Why don't you say what you're going to do?" "I don't have to use my tongue unless I want to." "You bastard. You scared bastard." "You ain't my boss," Gus said. "You yeller," Bigger said. "You scared to rob a white man." "Oh, Bigger, don't say that," G.H. said. "Leave him alone." "He's yeller," Bigger said. "He won't go with us." "I didn't say I wouldn't go," Gus said. "Then for Christ's sake, say what you're going to do," Bigger said. Gus leaned on his cue stick and gazed at Bigger, and Bigger's stomach tightened as though he were expecting a blow and were getting ready for it. His fists clenched harder. In a split second, he felt how his fist and arm and body would feel if he hit Gus squarely in the mouth, drawing blood. Gus would fall, and he would walk out, and the whole thing would be over, and the robbery would not take place. And his thinking and feeling in this way made the choking tightness rising from the pit of his stomach to his throat slacken a little. "You see, Bigger," began Gus in a tone that was a compromise between kindness and pride. "You see, Bigger, you the cause of all the trouble we ever have. It's your hot temper. Now how come you want to cuss me? Ain't I got a right to make up my mind? No, that ain't your way. You start cussing. You say I'm scared. It's you who's scared. You scared I'm going to say yes, and you'll have to go through with the job." "Say that again. Say that again, and I'll take one of these balls and sink it in your goddamn mouth," Bigger said, his pride wounded to the quick. "Oh, for Christ's sakes," Jack said. "You see how he is," Gus said. "Why don't you say what you're going to do?" Bigger demanded. "I'm going with y'all," Gus said in a nervous tone that sought to hide itself, a tone that hurried on to other things. "I'm going, but Bigger don't have to act like that. He don't have to cuss me." "Why didn't you say that at first?" Bigger asked. His anger amounted almost to frenzy. "You make a man want to sock you." "I'll help on the hall," Gus continued, as though Bigger had not spoken. "I'll help just like I always help, but I'll be goddamn if I'm taking orders from you, Bigger. You're just a scared coward. You calling me scared so nobody will see how scared you is." Bigger leaped at him, but Jack ran between them. G.H. caught Gus's arm and led him aside. "Who's asking you to take orders?" Bigger said. "I never want to give orders to a piss sop like you." "You boys cut out that racket back there," Doc called. They stood silently about the pool table. Bigger's eyes followed Gus as Gus put his cue stick in the rack and brushed chalk dust from his trousers and walked a little distance away. Bigger's stomach burned, and a hazy black cloud hovered a moment before his eyes and left. Mixed images of violence ran like sand through his mind, dry and fast, vanishing.
He could stab Gus with his knife. He could slap him. He could kick him. He could trip him up and send him sprawling on his face. He could do a lot of things to Gus for making him feel this way.
Come on, G.H., Gus said. Where are we going?
Let's walk.
Okay. What we gonna do? Jack asked. Meet here at 3?
Sure, Bigger said. Didn't we just decide?
I'll be here, Gus said, with his back turned.
When Gus and G.H. had gone, Bigger sat down and felt cold sweat on his skin. It was planned now, and he would have to go through with it. His teeth gritted, and the last image he had seen of Gus going through the door lingered in his mind. He could have taken one of the cue sticks and gripped it hard and swung it at the back of Gus's head, feeling the impact of the hard wood cracking against the bottom of the skull. The tight feeling was still in him, and he knew that it would remain until they were actually doing the job, until they were in the store taking the money.
You and Gus sure don't get along none, Jack said, shaking his head.
Bigger turned and looked at Jack. He had forgotten that Jack was still there.
Ah, that yellow black bastard, Bigger said.
He's all right, Jack said.
He's scared, Bigger said. To make him ready for a job, you have to make him scared two ways. You have to make him more scared of what'll happen to him if he don't do the job than of what'll happen to him if he pulls the job.
If we go into Blum's today, we oughtn't fuss like this, Jack said. We got a job on our hands, a real job.
Sure, sure, I know, Bigger said.
Bigger felt an urgent need to hide his growing and deepening feeling of hysteria. He had to get rid of it, or else he would succumb to it. He longed for a stimulus powerful enough to focus his attention and drain off his energies. He wanted to run, or listen to some swing music, or laugh or joke, or read a real detective story magazine, or go to a movie, or visit Bessie. All that morning he had lurked behind his curtain of indifference and looked at things, snapping and glaring at whatever had tried to make him come out into the open. But now he was out. The thought of the job at Blum's and the tilt he had had with Gus had snared him into things, and his self-trust was gone. Confidence could only come again now through action so violent that it would make him forget. These were the rhythms of his life, indifference and violence, periods of abstract brooding and periods of intense desire, moments of silence and moments of anger, like water ebbing and flowing from the tug of a faraway, invisible force. Being this way was a need of his as deep as eating. He was like a strange plant blooming in the day and wilting at night. But the sun that made it bloom and the cold darkness that made it wilt were never seen. It was his own sun and darkness, a private and personal sun and darkness. He was bitterly proud of his swiftly changing moods, and boasted when he had to suffer the results of them. It was the way he was, he would say. He could not help it, he would say, and his head would wag. And it was his sullen stare and the violent action that followed that made Gus and Jack and G.H. hate and fear him as much as he hated and feared himself.
Where you want to go? Jack asked. I'm tired of sitting.
Let's walk, Bigger said.
They went to the front door. Bigger paused and looked round the pool room with a wild and exasperated expression, his lips tightening with resolution.
Going?
Doc asked, not moving his head.
Yeah, Bigger said.
See you later, Jack said.
They walked along the street in the morning sunshine. They waited leisurely at corners for cars to pass. It was not that they feared cars, but they had plenty of time. They reached South Parkway, smoking freshly lit cigarettes.
I'd like to see a movie, Bigger said.
Trader Horn's running at the Regal. They're bringing a lot of old pictures back.
How much is it?
20 cents.
Okay, let's see it. They walked 6 blocks in silence. It was 11:30 when they reached 47th Street in South Parkway, and the Regal was just opening. They bought tickets and walked into the darkened movie and took seats. The picture had not yet started, and they sat listening to the pipe organ playing low and soft. Bigger moved restlessly, and his breath quickened. He looked round in the shadows to see if any attendant was near, then slouched far down in his seat. He glanced at Jack and saw that Jack was watching him out of the corners of his eyes. They both laughed.
"You at it again?"
Jack asked.
"I'm polishing my nightstick," Bigger said. They giggled.
"I beat you,"
Jack said.
"Go to hell."
The organ played for a long moment on a single note, then died away.
"I'll bet you ain't even hard yet,"
Jack whispered.
"I'm getting hard."
"Mine's like a rod,"
Jack said with intense pride.
"I wish I had Bessie here now," Bigger said.
"I can make old Clara moan now."
They sighed.
"I believe that woman who passed saw us."
"So what?"
"If she comes back, I'll throw it in her."
"You a killer."
"If she saw it, she'd faint."
"Or grab it, maybe."
"Yeah."
Bigger saw Jack lean forward and stretch out his legs, rigidly.
"You gone?"
"Yeah."
"You pull off fast."
Again, they were silent. Then Bigger leaned forward, breathing hard.
"I'm gone. God damn."
They sat still for 5 minutes, slumped down in their seats. Finally, they straightened.
"I don't know where to put my feet now,"
Bigger said, laughing. "Let's take another seat."
"Okay."
They moved to other seats. The organ still played. Now and then they glanced back up to the projector's room high in the rear of the theater. They were impatient for the picture to start. When they spoke again, their voices were throaty, drawling, tinged with uneasiness.
"You reckon it'll go all right?"
Bigger asked.
"Maybe."
"I'd just as soon go to jail as take that relief job."
"Don't say that."
"I don't give a damn."
"Let's think about how we'll do it, not about how we'll get caught."
"Scared?"
"Hell no."
They listened to the pipe organ. It was humming so low that it could scarcely be heard. There were times when it seemed to stop altogether. Then it would surge forth again, mellow, nostalgic, sweet.
"We better take our guns this time," Bigger said.
"Okay, but we gotta be careful. We don't want to kill nobody."
"Yeah, but I'll feel safer with a gun this time."
"Gee, I wish it was 3 now. I wished it was over."
"Me too."
The organ stopped, and the screen flashed with the rhythm of moving shadows. Bigger sat looking at the first picture. It was a newsreel. As the scenes unfolded, his interest was caught, and he leaned forward. He saw images of smiling, dark-haired white girls lolling on the gleaming sands of a beach. The background was a stretch of sparkling water. Palm trees stood near and far. The voice of the commentator ran with the movement of the film.
"Here are the daughters of the rich taking sunbaths in the sands of Florida. This little collection of debutantes represents over $4 billion of America's wealth and over 50 of America's leading families."
"Some babies,"
Jack said.
"Yeah, man."
"I'd like to be there."
"You can," Bigger said. "But you'd be hanging from a tree like a bunch of bananas."
They laughed softly and easily, listening to the commentator's voice. The scene shifted to and fro over the glittering sands. Then Bigger saw in close-up the picture of a slight, smiling white girl whose waist was encircled by the arms of a man. He heard the commentator's voice.
"Mary Dalton, daughter of Chicago's Henry Dalton,
4605 Drexel Boulevard, shock society by spurning the boys of LaSalle Street and the Gold Coast and accepting the attentions of a well-known radical while on her recent winter vacation in Florida.
The close-up showed the smiling girl kissing the man, who lifted her up and swung her round from the camera.
Say, Jack.
Huh?
That gal. That gal there in the guy's arms? That's the daughter of the guy I'm going to work for. They live at 4605 Drexel. That's where I'm going tonight to see about that job.
For real?
Sure.
The close-up faded, and the next scene showed only the girl's legs running over the sparkling sands. They were followed by the legs of the man running in pursuit. The words droned on.
Ah, he's after her. There, he's got her. Oh, boy. Don't you wish you were down here in Florida?
The close-up faded, and another came, showing two pairs of legs standing close together.
Oh, boy, said the voice.
Slowly, the girl's legs strained upward until only the tips of her toes touched the sand.
Ah, the naughty rich!
There was a slow fade-out, while the commentator's voice ran on.
Shortly after a scene like this, shocked Mama and Papa Dalton summoned Mary home by wire from her winter vacation and denounced her communist friend.
Say, Jack.
Yeah?
What's a communist?
Damn if I know. It's a race of people who live in Russia, ain't it?
That guy who was kissing old man Dalton's daughter was a communist, and her folks didn't like it.
Rich people don't like communists.
She was a hot-looking number, all right.
Sure, Jack said. When you start working there, you gotta learn to stand in with it. Then you can get everything you want, see? These rich folks do their dirt on the sly. I bet the reason the old man was so mad about that communist was 'cause his gal was too open about it.
Yeah, maybe so, said Bigger.
Shucks, my ma used to work for rich white folks, and you ought to hear the tales she used to tell.
What kind of tales? Bigger asked eagerly.
Ah, them rich white women will go to bed with anybody, from a poodle on up. They even have their chauffeur. Say,
Jack said, punching Bigger in the ribs,
if you run across anything too much for you to handle at that place, let me know.
This ends Disc 1. Native Son, Disc 2.
They laughed. Bigger turned his eyes to the screen, but he did not look. He was filled with a sense of excitement about his new job. Was what he had heard about rich white people really true? Was he going to work for people like he saw in the movies? If he were, then he'd see a lot of things from the inside. He'd get the dope, the lowdown. He looked at Trader Horn unfold and saw pictures of naked black men and women whirling in wild dances and heard drums beating, and then gradually the African scene changed and was replaced by images in his own mind of white men and women dressed in black and white clothes, laughing, talking, drinking, and dancing. Those were smart people. They knew how to get hold of money, millions of it. Maybe if he were working for them, something would happen, and he would get some of it. He would see just how they did it. Sure, it was all a game, and white people knew how to play it. And rich white people were not so hard on Negroes. It was the poor whites who hated Negroes. They hated Negroes because they didn't have their share of the money. His mother had always told him that rich white people liked Negroes better than they did poor whites. He felt that if he were a poor white and did not get his share of the money, then he would deserve to be kicked. Poor white people were stupid. It was the rich white people who were smart and knew how to treat people. He remembered hearing somebody tell a story of a Negro chauffeur who had married a rich white girl, and that girl's family had shipped the couple out of the country and had supplied them with money. Yes, his going to work for the Daltons was something big. Mr. Dalton was a millionaire. Maybe Mary Dalton was a hot kind of girl. Maybe she spent lots of money. Maybe she'd like to come to the South Side and see the sights sometime. Or maybe She had a secret sweetheart, and only he would know about it, because he would have to drive her around. Maybe she would give him money not to tell. He was a fool for wanting to rob Blum's just when he was about to get a good job. Why hadn't he thought of that before? Why take a fool's chance when other things, big things, could happen? If something slipped up this afternoon, he would be out of a job and in jail, maybe. And he wasn't so hot about robbing Blum's, anyway. He frowned in the darkened movie, hearing the roll of tom-toms and the screams of black men and women dancing free and wild. Men and women who were adjusted to their soil and at home in their world, secure from fear and hysteria.
"Come on, Bigger," Jack said. "We gotta go."
"Huh?"
"It's 20 to 3.
He rose and walked down the dark aisle over the soft, invisible carpet. He had seen practically nothing of the picture, but he did not care. As he walked into the lobby, his insides tightened again with the thought of Gus and Blum's.
"Swell, wasn't it?"
"Yeah, it was a killer," Bigger said. He walked alongside Jack briskly until they came to 39th Street. "We better get our guns," Bigger said.
"Yeah."
"We got about 15 minutes.
"Okay."
"So long." He walked home with a mounting feeling of fear. When he reached his doorway, he hesitated about going up. He didn't want to rob Blum's. He was scared. But he had to go through with it now. Noiselessly, he went up the steps and inserted his key in the lock. The door swung in silently, and he heard his mother singing behind the curtain.
"Lord, I want to be a Christian. In my heart, in my heart. Lord, I want to be a Christian. In my heart, in my heart."
He tiptoed into the room and lifted the top mattress of his bed and pulled forth the gun and slipped it inside his shirt. Just as he was about to open the door, his mother paused in her singing.
"That you, Bigger?"
He stepped quickly into the outer hallway and slammed the door and bounded headlong down the stairs. He went to the vestibule and swung through the door into the street, feeling that ball of hot tightness growing larger and heavier in his stomach and chest. He opened his mouth to breathe. He headed for Doc's and came to the door and looked inside. Jack and G.H. were shooting pool at a rear table. Gus was not there. He felt a slight lessening of nervous tension and swallowed. He looked up and down the street. Very few people were out, and the cop was not in sight.